From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is Cool Science Radio, science and technology that's interesting, fun, and understandable. I'm John Wells. I'm here with Linware Peak. Our first guest this morning, Dr. Dahlia Kirschbaum, research physical scientist and GPM application scientist at NASA Goddard. Now, GPM stands for Global Precipitation and Measurement Satellite, and it's quite a satellite. The GPM is an international satellite mission to provide next-generation observations of rain and snow worldwide every 3 hours. NASA and the Japanese Aerospace Exploration Agency launched the GPM Core Observatory satellite in February of 2014, carrying advanced instruments that set a new standard for precipitation measurement from space. We spoke with Dr. Kirschbaum several months after the launch when GPM was going through a shakedown cruise and calibration of its instrumentation. We spoke with her again last March, and we have invited her back once again to hear what GPM has learned about our new climate. You won't want to miss this conversation, as GPM is a satellite like no other.
That's right, John. Good morning. I'm Lynn Ware Peak. Our second guest this morning is Bill Andrews, who's the senior associate editor for Discover magazine. Every year at this time, Discover publishes their pick of the top 100 science stories of the previous year. We look forward to this conversation every year as we take a look at a handful of the top 100, their relevance in 2016, and where they may take us in the future, 2017 and beyond. 2 weeks ago, we covered a handful of stories in part one of our conversation, and now we've invited Bill back for part two of the top 100 science stories of 2016.
These two guests plus today's cool stories when we return. You're listening to Cool Science Radio. Stay with us.
I'm Beth Lohman from Park City Mountain and supporter of KPCW. Park City Mountain's Epic Promise grants and donations focus on youth programs and environmental initiatives that impact our local communities. Grants fund programs that are designed to help kids achieve in the classroom and develop an interest for the outdoors by engaging guests, local communities, and our employees. Information at epicpromise.com.
This is Dr. Phil Davidson of Davidson Orthopedics, proud KPCW sponsor of Cool Science Radio. Have you been told you need a total knee or shoulder joint replacement? Information about alternatives is available on our website at davidsonorthopedics.com.
And welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm John Wells. I'm here with my co-host, Lynn Ware Peak. Our first guest this morning, Dr. Dahlia Kirschbaum, is research physical scientist and GPM application scientist at NASA Goddard. Once again, I've got to cover all the acronyms. GPM stands for Global Precipitation and Measurement Satellite. The GPM data is used to unify precipitation measurements made by our international network of partner satellites to quantify when, where, and how much it rains or snows around the world. The GPM mission contributes to our advancing understanding of Earth's water and energy cycles, improves the forecasting of extreme events that cause natural disasters, and extends current capabilities of using satellite precipitation information to directly benefit society. Dahlia, welcome back to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah. You know, the GPM satellite's been very busy. Tell us what she's been up to and how she's doing.
That's right. Well, the Global Precipitation Measurement Mission Core Satellite, which you gave so nice an introduction for, launched in February of 2014. It's been up for 1,056 days, and every day, every month, it delivers over 5 terabytes of data to thousands and thousands of users around the world. And, you know, it's building on this incredible legacy that the Tropical Rainfall Measuring Mission, or TRIM, set when it launched in 1997. And so what we're learning are things like, you know, Hurricane Matthew. With the GPM satellite, we were able to see how Hurricane Matthew, which made landfall, the first big storm to make landfall in the recent decade, how it intensified in the Caribbean, how it went through an eyewall replacement, meaning that the eye of the storm changed significantly and caused the storm to change. And we're able to look at the rainfall totals that caused significant flooding in, for example, South Carolina during that storm. So the tremendous applications of this mission and the research that we're learning in just these basically 3 years have really been eye-opening.
For our listeners who are at home and for those that are driving, just make note of this. Google Global Precipitation Management Satellite, and you'll be able to take a look at some of these pictures. Some of these are in three dimensions, and they're absolutely fascinating. Dahlia, I wanted to ask you, as a result of our new climate, we understand that there's more moisture in the atmosphere. Are some rainstorms more intense? Are hurricanes more intense? Does GPM help us to understand what we're looking at as a new climate?
You know, one of the important things about understanding how our climate is and how it's been is taking these global observations of precipitation. So GPM's fairly short record is really telling us what's going on now. And looking back in the past from TRIM, you know, we're able to look back another 17 years. If you couple that with other observations like the Global Precipitation Climatology Product, that really takes us almost back to the, you know, the 1979 or 1980s. And so what this is able to tell us is how precipitation around the world is changing, not only on a daily basis, but a seasonal and a yearly basis. You know, in looking at the climate trends, it's really difficult to figure out in any given year what's happening locally, because there's so many different ways that the weather systems are modulated by big systems like the El Nino circulation. But what this does tell us is that we understand how extreme precipitation has generally been changing in the last couple decades. You know, the models and observations are telling us it seems that, you know, the average amount of moisture or precipitation in the atmosphere, you know, hasn't changed significantly, but that it is likely that we're going to be getting more extreme, so more wet conditions, more dry conditions, and that can really have a huge impact on natural hazards, you know, causing more extreme flooding, more extreme droughts and famine, as well as, you know, helping us to try to figure out how to better model our climate in the future. And these fundamental observations from GPM and a host of other satellites just give us those key clues now into how we might model our future weather and climate.
It seems really interesting to me, Dahlia, that we have been going on our information for so many decades, even centuries, about those weather trends. And then right about the time when the trends are being bucked and challenged, really, by these extreme weather events, that along comes the global precipitation measurement satellite at a really good time to be able to fill in the void where trends can no longer.
Right. So, you know, I think one important thing for all the listeners out there is to really differentiate operational weather satellites from what GPM is, the Global Precipitation Measurement Mission. Now, we have a history of new next-generation weather satellites. In fact, the GOES-R satellite, which is now GOES 16, is a combination effort between NASA and NOAA that launched in November 16th, 2016. And that, as well as the Joint Polar Satellite System, that's just a U.S. effort, has helped us to provide this continuity of weather observations. But with the Global Precipitation Measurement Mission and the TRIM satellite before that, have allowed us to do is expand the bounds of how we really understand precipitation, everything from light rain to heavy rain and snow. And that's really been very eye-opening with GPM, is allowing us to not only see what's happening in the tropics, but what's happening all the way to the high latitudes, where, you know, snowfall and light rainfall are such a huge contributor to freshwater resources. And so that is how, you know, that's why GPM is really complementing our, you know, operational observations from satellites maintained by NOAA and others, and allowing us to kind of push the envelope, move forward with the cutting edge in terms of better understanding and modeling our weather and ultimately our climate.
You know, I'm reading within some of your research and data showing that within the past 5 years, extreme weather events have been responsible for more than 254,000 fatalities worldwide. That's a pretty staggering number. What do you hope to sort of, what kind of change do you hope to affect?
Well, the Global Precipitation Measurement Mission, which is not just one satellite, it's actually a constellation of both domestic and international satellites, over 10 satellites that provide this global picture in near real time. So within, you know, every 30 minutes, we get a sense of what's happening in each grid cell around the world. And so that data is really fundamental for better understanding impacts from these events like floods or landslides, which is my research area, and then kind of longer term looking at agricultural drought, looking at all of the different components of where precipitation might influence society. And so hydrometeorological hazards, such as what's being caused by when you have extreme precipitation, is by and large the largest number of fatalities resulting from hazards. So I think that as we move forward and we make this data readily accessible, it's all free and open, but make rainfall readily accessible to the communities around the world, we hope to better and to better inform emergency response, emergency planning, as well as, you know, non-governmental organizations and other, you know, government agencies that really need to know when, where, and how much rainfall is happening so that they can better prepare their populations to be more resilient to these types of events.
For our listeners, and Dahlia, please correct me if I'm wrong, the GPM is, well, it's the size of a bus, and it has a very extensive instrumentation package. And as you mentioned, there are 9 other satellites that it interrogates to be able to put together a full picture of what it sees. Can you tell me about the GOES-R satellite? I know it had a successful launch in this past November. Is it still in shakedown and calibration of instrumentation, or is it starting to provide value?
The GOES-R is really one of the is a next step in the series of operational satellites that are operated by NOAA. It provides both redundancy and advanced instrument packages that allow us to look at things like lightning, allow us to look at a specific point on the globe and really see how weather is changing at a very local scale. And so while I can't kind of speak to the specifics in the terms of the current status of GOES-16, I know that it was a very successful launch, and we hope and look forward to the data that it is providing to better inform our research here at NASA as well as the weather community around the world.
Dr. Kirschbaum, you've been involved with GPM years before it was even launched. Throughout this entire period of time, including its implementation and what it's doing and what it's been doing the last several years, what has most surprised you about GPM?
Well, I think it's important to understand how long these missions take to kind of come to realization. So just to give you an example, you know, this concept started way before I got to NASA. You know, it started over a decade or a decade and a half before GPM was actually launched. And so one of the things that's surprising is, you know, we spend decades working through the engineering problems, the science questions that we're going to address with this mission. And it's launched, and within days, literally days, we had the instruments up and running. We captured a significant snowstorm image on the East Coast to better understand kind of the difference between snow and rain off the coast. And then users started using this data right away. So I think what's really exciting is not only how, you know, you spend all this time building a mission and it works so well. Another surprising thing about this is because of the sensitivity of the instruments on board the GPM satellite, we have both a radar, which allows you to look in 2 frequencies at in 3 dimensions of the clouds. And we also have a GPM microwave imager, which allows us sort of like an X-ray to see the whole view of a storm from light rain to heavy rain and snow. So if you take 1 orbit from GPM, which is 90 minutes around the globe, you can actually see all the different types of precipitation in 3 dimensions as we move across our globe from the Arctic to the Antarctic Circle. And so that has really been a surprising thing in terms of being able to not only see the individual particles, but we can also see how this precipitation is distributed around the whole world.
Oh, it's so fascinating. So you talked earlier about the amount of data collected by the Global Precipitation Measurement Mission, and that was, you mentioned 5 terabytes. Who can digest this? I mean, if you wanted to look up those cross sections and look at the individual particles, which, you know, we're all becoming more and more of weather geeks as we have these extreme weather events, but how can we consume it, the layperson?
That's a great question. You know, with the Global Precipitation Measurement Mission, you know, the precipitation data that it provides, we are working towards making this data, this free and open data, as accessible as possible to anyone. So we have if you go to pmm.nasa.gov, there's actually a viewer that allows you to look in real time at what's happening over the past 30 minutes, over the past day or 7 days of rainfall. Now, who's using this data is pretty surprising. So, of course, it makes sense that, you know, the meteorological agencies around the world, the Met services, you know, everybody from Europe to Japan to the United States are pulling in this data routinely to improve their weather predictions and improve their cyclone tracking. But there's also groups like agricultural groups in the U.S. and internationally that use this data every day to make better predictions about crops, and essentially anticipate the future growing seasons and the yields of crops, which is very important to understand how to mobilize aid when needed. You know, another example is for disasters. You know, people like the Alaska fire managers, you know, there's a lot of problems with understanding where precipitation is when you don't have ground-based gauges or ground-based radar. And so there's actually a training that's going to be happening this in just a month or two, where we're working with the Alaska fire managers to teach them how to use this data so that they are able to get a much better understanding of fire risks in their own backyard where we don't have weather data. Yeah. So, I mean, the examples abound, but I think that it's just tremendous to be able to provide that data in a way that hopefully is as easy to use as literally looking at your phone and seeing what's happening in your own backyard.
Right. Speaking of our own backyard and the area of study and research that you say that you specialize in, which is landslides, let's talk a little bit about landslides. We know that with extreme weather events, with more precipitation falling during a shorter time period, the ground gets saturated, landslides abound. There's some sort of algorithm within what you're doing that's going to allow you to predict on a wider scale, you know, going from localized into a wider scale where landslides are going to occur. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Absolutely. So some work that I've been doing is trying to not predict, but give a near real-time what the disaster community calls situational awareness. So what is the general trends in terms of where and when we might have landslides? So to do that, we actually have a global model that allows us to see susceptibility. So what that means is kind of where landslides are generally likely to happen based on the slope, based on the land cover type, and many other variables. And then we have the rainfall from GPM, from the Global Precipitation Measurement Mission. And so with that, looking at those two things together, we can actually get a relative sense of where we might have more landslide activity. And so, you know, this is still an evolving model and an evolving tool. But, you know, groups like the Pacific Disaster Center or the World Food Program are really looking at where they might need to focus their efforts or communicate with their end users about potential hazards or potential, you know, landslide potential around the world. And so we continue to improve that, and we actually have some projects, one focused in the Pacific Northwest United States, focusing in Washington and Oregon to even do a better job, and we're working closely with the U.S. Geological Survey on that. And another project that I have is looking at landslides in Nepal and the High Mountain Asia region to get a much better understanding of how, you know, changes in rainfall, changes in road networks, and many other factors might be able to how they really impact landslide frequency and how landslides impact the populations in that area.
Talia, I'm curious about this. With the instrumentation package, for an example, the microwave imager that looks at 13 different microwave channels, or the dual frequency precipitation radar, which I believe was developed by the Japanese, that provides a three-dimensional information about precipitation particles. When we look at particles, when you look at particles, you're not actually these instruments don't actually track particles. They track energy. They're looking at the energy that's given off by these particles.
That's right. So if you look at the analogy of, you know, how we see colors. So our eyes are a passive system, right? So our eyes, based on sunlight bouncing off of different objects, the wavelength of light that we see in our eye receptors allows us to see the difference between red and green and blue and yellow across the spectrum. Now, with the active system, essentially it is providing an active signal that bounces off the particles. So that is microwave energy, which it emits, and based on the response of the particles bouncing the energy from them, we can actually tell the difference between the shape of the particles, and their distribution. And being able to have this two different frequencies really allows us to get a much better understanding of how rainfall is distributed in the total atmospheric column. Now, why do we care, right? I mean, this is really cool research-wise, but in order to understand and better improve our weather models, the operational weather models, right now, you know, and it's evolving very quickly, we kind of, the weather models use very generalized information about the particles because there isn't a lot of data. So we are working to build a database with our operational partners to better understand how we can take data from the individual particles in the column to really improve our weather modeling at the big picture scale.
Oh, that's fascinating. Dahlia, since we began speaking with you in 2014, your responsibilities have changed. They have increased. Tell us what your current responsibilities are. What are you doing?
Well, I have many different hats, which has really been an amazing opportunity here at NASA. You know, in addition to working with the Global Precipitation Measurement Mission and working to outline, discuss, and train groups on how to use the data, I also, you know, am continuing my landslide research, which has been very exciting. And then I've also morphed into other activities like disaster response. So NASA has a disasters program, and we have been working across the agency at all of the different NASA centers about how to coordinate our efforts and support our operational partners during disasters around the world. And so that's been really eye-opening to try to provide meaningful and useful data to the emergency managers, groups like FEMA and others, as well as international organizations like the Office of Foreign Disaster Assistance through USAID, you know, trying to give good and informative data and products to support disaster activities as a response as they're happening, and also help with response and recovery. And that's been really exciting to be part of, so that NASA data, which, you know, I mentioned multiple times, is free and open, we can provide information that really hopefully can make a difference in saving lives and improving response efforts around the world.
Dahlia, are you able to talk specifically about a recent sort of weather event or disaster that you've worked with FEMA on or some of these other emergency organizations?
Absolutely. So one of the most recent in the United States was the rainfall that continues to fall in California, Northern California,
yeah,
and Oregon. You know, they've had a tremendous Pineapple Express, they call it, which,
yeah,
is an atmospheric river of moisture that's caused, you know, pretty significant flooding and landslides in, you know, Northern California. And so one of the things that we did for that event is, you know, we talked to our colleagues at Ames Research Center, NASA Ames out in California, and our Jet Propulsion Lab group that's in Pasadena, California. Some of the coordinators from our disasters program are sitting on calls with FEMA and other response organizations to provide relevant information for their response effort. Personally, from a landslide perspective, you know, I've been emailing and coordinating back and forth with the U.S. Geological Survey regarding landslides. There have been some detected, fortunately no devastating ones at this point. And so, you know, the goal is really to, in the U.S. in particular, to provide data where it is relevant so that groups such as FEMA can have all of these different tools at the ready to make informed decisions about where to distribute aid and where to respond, you know, at different times.
That's nice. Well, you know, that Pineapple Express, when it comes across the desert and hits the Wasatch Mountains in Utah, has been dropping huge amounts of snow in our little mountain town. And
right,
our snowplow crews have been working around the clock, especially now with Sundance Film Festival, which begins today, trying to get snow out of our little mountain town streets that seem to be narrower and narrower as the snow piles up. What is something that you can, you know, if snowplow crews and our emergency manager is listening right now, what's something you can tell them about, you know, this trend in how you're taking science in to help better predict and help out people like them?
Sure. Well, I think what's important to note is that, you know, the weather forecasting, you know, NOAA, the National Oceanographic Administration, Atmospheric Administration, and the National Weather Service is really the lead organization for all weather alerts, weather activities, And NASA builds many of the satellites that NOAA runs operationally. But what I can say is one of the really cool research things that we've been working on in the past 2.5 years is the satellites, the instruments on board the Global Precipitation Measurement Mission. The goal was to detect falling snow. And so if you think about, you know, Park City, it's, you know, there's mountains all over. And so ground-based radar from the ground can't necessarily see all of the different areas where there might be falling snow. Now, what GPM is able to do is look from space layer by layer through the atmosphere about every 500 meters, and they can actually detect snow. And we're working on detecting snow rates in areas where we can't see it with ground-based radar. And so, you know, it's NASA is trying to push the envelope of understanding snow. In fact, the project scientist of the Global Precipitation Measurement Mission, Dr. Gail Skafanik-Jackson, said that really she's a snow expert, and she said we are understanding snow where we were with rain 40 years ago. So there's a lot we still don't know. And so we're working with NOAA and other operational partners to try to better understand snow, where it's falling, how much is falling, and hopefully improve our weather forecast so that you are able to have a much better prediction of, in the future, of how much snow might be accumulating. But it remains a really difficult field, so it's a team effort. Absolutely.
Dahlia, in addition to your normal software updates and patches that you're probably able to implement into GPM, are you able to upgrade any of the instrumentation to look at a different frequency or to do certain tweaking so that, for an example, you can look at the snow levels that and the granularity of the snow data that you'd like to have?
That's a great question. You know, unfortunately, I mean, let me start with positive. The algorithms, or essentially the way that we translate data that the satellite gets to meaningful rain and snow estimates on the ground, we have been working to continually improve them with better data. The more information comes in, the better we can do in terms of improving our algorithms. We can't change any of the hardware specifications on the satellite. We can't change the frequencies or the channels that we look at, because those are all hardwired on the satellite. And there are no, at present, capabilities to go back and make changes like they did with Hubble. That's not possible. So you really have to get that right the first time. And so we were very lucky that the team, the tremendous team of scientists and engineers, got this mission launched, in flawless conditions, essentially. But the thing that we're working towards is improving our algorithms. And as we learn more from the data that the satellite collects, we are able to get better estimates. But we're also looking towards the future into what the next big mission is. And so there's been a lot of great ideas of what the next, you know, what the next satellite, what instruments might be on board to further expand our capabilities and sensitivities to different types of precipitation.
Fascinating. Dr. Dahlia Kirschbaum, NASA Goddard Research Physical Scientist and GPM Application Scientist, and a whole bunch of other responsibilities. We want to thank you again for joining us. We love having you on Cool Science Radio.
Thank you. It's such a pleasure to be on. We really appreciate all the interest that you show.
Okay, thanks, great. Dahlia.
Thanks, Dahlia.
Bye.
Take care. Bye.
Well, that was... she's
great stuff.
She has a lot of enthusiasm, and that's
a lot of information.
When we return, we're going to have a conversation with Bill Andrews, who's the senior associate editor for Discover magazine. You are listening to Cool Science Radio. Stay with us.
This is Earl Foote, founder of Nexus IT, a proud sponsor of Cool Science Radio on KPCW. Nexus IT provides comprehensive cybersecurity solutions to help protect your business from hackers and today's internet-borne security threats. More information at nexusitc.net or at 435-487-9099.
This is Steve Roney with Berkshire Hathaway Home Services Utah Properties. We continue to be proud supporters of KPCW, our local source for Park City news. Our agents are Summit and Wasatch County's source for real estate, and we can be reached at bhhsutah.com.
Hi, this is Dr. Juliana Miller from Miller Orthodontics, a proud supporter of The Local View with Randy Barton. With a combined 45 years of orthodontic experience, my husband and I are now raising our family and working full-time in the Park City community. There are so many reasons to smile in Park City. More information at m2ortho.com.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peake, here with John Wells. We were just speaking with Dr. Dahlia Kirschbaum, research physical scientist and GPM, as in Global Precipitation Measurement Application Scientist at NASA Goddard. Always a fascinating interview with Dahlia. Our next guest is Bill Andrews, who's the senior associate editor for Discover Magazine. Bill was with us 2 weeks ago to talk about some of the top science stories in Discover's Top 100 issue. Due to popular demand, we have invited Bill back so he can talk about some of the stories we weren't able to get to before, such as, oh, the mystery of fast radio bursts, next generation spaceflight, perhaps, and a recently discovered 79th human organ, or maybe a non-organ. Bill Andrews, welcome back to Cool Science Radio.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much. It's good to be back.
Yes, so quickly. We love it for this part two. You know, we could go on talking about Discover's 100 top stories of 2016 for the next couple of months, but we thought we'd invite you back. And last time we sort of talked about the stories we were fascinated by, but what did we miss? Your favorite, you know, top couple of stories from 2016?
Well, I mean, I am a parent, so it's an easy line for me to say. It's hard to choose. They're all my favorites in this yeah. issue. We work so hard on them. We're actually starting to plan meetings for next year's Year in Science issue because, as you can imagine, this is a year-long endeavor for us. So, but all that being said, I guess I do have a few that I did like and I think are kind of neat to talk about. So one of them is actually, and I don't think we talked about this last time, the number two story. About a new planet found at the closest star to the sun. That star is Proxima Centauri. It's part of the Alpha Centauri system. And the neat thing about it, I guess there's a few neat things. The first neat thing is that it's a planet that we found around another star, so it's an exoplanet, and it turns out it's in that star's habitable zone, which means it has the kind of orbit around the star where liquid water is possible on the planet's surface. So that's neat, right? That's already a good start. We've only found a few planets in habitable zones before. And the fact that the closest possible planet to us, there can be no other planets closer because this is the closest star, is a potentially, maybe, possibly habitable world. That's cool already. The other neat thing about it, though, is that the star, Proxima Centauri, is a different kind of star from our sun. Proxima Centauri is a red dwarf, which is a dimmer star. It's a little cooler, and it's also much more common throughout the galaxy. There's about 100 billion stars in the Milky Way, and 75 billion of them are red dwarfs. And scientists didn't know if they could have planets, if the conditions that form planets would also work around red dwarfs. So now that they know, that really opens up the door to all. Now there's way more exoplanets out there that are possible. And so that's also kind of neat. Like it really, the cup is overflowing with exoplanets now.
Wow. How about that? So go into, if you would, the definition of what constitutes a red dwarf. Doesn't it have something to do also with radiation?
Yeah, I mean, there's a spectrum for stars that, depending on how big they are and correspondingly how bright they are, what kind of light they emit, if it's mostly in the visible spectrum, our sun, of course, has a lot of visible light coming from it, but not all stars do. Some have more in the infrared spectrum and some have more in the opposite end, the purple end, and it's all kinds of stars exist out there. And red dwarfs are, like I said, a very popular kind of star in the cosmos, and they're a lot smaller. They live a lot longer because they kind of keep their heads down and they keep to themselves. They don't go out with a bang like the biggest stars do, become supernovas. Our own sun will expand tremendously in a few billion years and probably engulf the first few planets, and it'll be a big, huge scene. Red dwarfs won't probably have that kind of activity. They're smaller, they're dimmer, and they have different kinds of emissions that we're not certain exactly what it would mean for a planet orbiting them. So we can't say that this new planet around Proxima Centauri is a definitely habitable. It might be that the stars, violent outbursts of occasional infrared lights and everything make it too difficult for life to stay there. We just don't know yet. But the cool thing, and this is my attempt at a cool radio segue, is that there is another story in the issue, number 100, that would help us answer these kinds of questions about Proxima B.
Well, let's talk about those then.
Yeah, well, perfect. I'm glad it worked. The story in question, number 100, is about a new project that was announced early in 2016 called the Breakthrough Starshot. And the whole idea is that we might be able to get send probes from Earth and arrive at the nearest star system, which, again, includes Proxima Centauri, and have them get there within 40 years or so. And that's crazy. That is absolutely, you know, Looney Tunes. Like, yeah. for astronomers, for physicists, these stellar distances have just been pretty much impossible to traverse. It takes us 10 years to send a probe to Pluto right now. So imagine a star that's, you know, tens and tens and probably more, hundreds of times farther away, 25 trillion miles or so to Proxima Centauri. But this guy in Russia named Yuri Milner, I think of him as kind of the Russian equivalent to Elon Musk. He's a billionaire. He's got a lot of cool ideas, and he wants to put them into use. Came up with this plan that apparently all the physicists say would really work to get a probe out there to Proxima Centauri within 40 years or so. The plan sounds like science fiction, but I mean that's what we're talking about right now anyway. It would involve the construction of a lot of little nanoprobes, which isn't literally nano size, but they would be the kind of things that you can hold in your hand, and we'd have tons of them, maybe thousands, so that if a few go off course, okay, no big deal. We'd attach those things to solar sails, which are a proven technology. Light, because light is a weird and wonderful substance, even though it doesn't have mass, it does have momentum. So just light by itself can push things along like wind pushes a sail. And there have been probes in the solar system that have been moved around purely from the sun's light pushing it. Nothing else, no wind or anything like that. So if we could set up some kind of light sail technology, that's kind of the next step. We're working on that. There's possible materials. You attach something like a parachute of this stuff to each of those little probes. You launch them into space with a conventional rocket. And then, here's the really crazy part, there's some kind of park on Earth in the future that will be able to send a huge amount of laser light, just all these laser beams aimed into space, into each individual little parachute. And so, with just that light's momentum imparted onto this little probe, it would be able to accelerate to a significant fraction of the speed of light. And that's, again, that's what's really crazy. Yeah, we are nowhere near that for people, for materials, we thought, but because these things would be so light, because light is so powerful, it would actually be able to get these things going to about a fifth of the speed of light. So,
well, that's incredible, Bill.
Light speed, a lot of crazy stuff.
Which is the speed limit of the universe in miles per hour is 186,000 miles per second, actually. And so 20% of that would be 40 million miles per second. And I think spacecraft, I think our max is, what, about 37,000 miles per hour?
Yeah, that sounds pretty fast.
That is nothing next to this. This is one-fifth, 20% of light speed. Well, that's incredible.
Yeah. Right. And it seems possible. That's the best part. Like, they haven't built it yet. They don't know how to get these lasers calibrated or anything yet. They don't actually have the sails built yet, but they should be possible. And so the plan is figure all this out within 20 years, launch these things 20 years from now, and then at a fifth of the speed of light, the star system's about 4 light years away, so it would take 20 years in transit. So theoretically, 40 years from now, we would have probes around another star system.
Right.
Ridiculous. Yeah, but amazing.
Bill, I wanted to ask you a question, and it may be a really naive question, but I just want to throw it out there anyway.
No such thing.
So we have these astronomers that are constantly looking at our galaxy and constantly looking at the universe, and when they see these different galactic structures, they've been able to determine, based on the way that they are arranged and the way they behave gravitationally, that there must be a lot of dark matter out there that we don't see. And some astronomers say as much as 95 or 98% of the matter is unseeable. It's dark matter. And so if that's true, I want to go back to when we talked about the ninth planet a couple of weeks ago, where we've not been able to locate this planet yet in our own solar system. However, people really feel that it's there, but we haven't located it. Is it possible that it's made up of dark matter?
Okay. Well, the quick answer is sure, maybe, because we don't know what dark matter is, so we can't rule it out per se. We haven't seen the planet, so it's possible. But I don't think so. And my reasoning for it is thus. Dark matter really, really doesn't influence things on much of a scale until you get to the galaxy size. When, like you said, a lot of these other galaxies out there behave in a way gravitationally that doesn't make sense unless you account for this unseeable matter that they don't know what it is, so they call it dark matter. And when you get to smaller scales like a solar system, which is big enough to us, of course, but it's nothing next to the galaxy, dark matter doesn't really have as big of an effect then. And so even if there were something, some kind of concentration of stuff, of whatever this dark matter stuff is, I don't think it would behave the same way. It would have the same kind of ripples and affect other objects' orbits the way that a planet would. And so that's why the Caltech astronomers felt pretty confident saying that it was likely just a regular planet that we haven't seen yet. Well, but that's just my understanding, so I could be mistaken. Like I said, we don't know. Until you see it, you never know.
Well, that's a good answer. I thank you.
Oh, well, thank you.
Our guest is Bill Andrews. He's the senior associate editor for Discover Magazine. And Bill, I'm going to put you on the spot a little bit, because I remember a couple years ago when we talked to you, for the first time, you talking a little bit about your background. And as you sit here and talk about astronomy and perhaps astrophysics, it seems like that is your area of expertise, really. But as an associate editor, you have to sort of have a mini master's degree in all of these sciences that come together and make up the top 100 stories. Talk a little bit about where you come from. I love this story, and I've retold it a few times.
Wow. Well, I mean, okay. I hope I can live up to the story that it's become.
I'm sure I embellished along the way for my own purposes.
Don't feel bad, Bill. She puts me on the spot all the time.
As do I. Yeah, I guess so. Well, sure. I mean, I'll address the first part of your question first. I mean, yeah, I do kind of specialize in space and astro stuff. That is kind of my beat in journalism talk. But, yeah, it's not exclusive. I'm not exclusive to that stuff. I like all the different sciences. Again, it's hard to choose. They're like all of my children. It's just I happen to know one a little better than the others, and I guess this metaphor isn't working so well. but, yeah, I also edit other sciences. A lot of environmental stories and dinosaurs are really popular, so I have to know a bit about them. Math and chemistry and some of those other so-called hard sciences and all the bio stuff, all the life. Medicine is such a big thing. I feel like I'm not a medical writer necessarily, so my expertise isn't great there, but I have to know a fair amount of what's going on there too. I mean, the CRISPR gene editing, I think of it as software, but it's just literally gene manipulation techniques that biologists have found. All that stuff is crazy. And yeah, being in science journalism, you kind of have to be able to keep up with all of it unless you are nothing but just a purely devoted space researcher or space writer. And I don't know enough about space to be nothing but that. So, yeah, and of course, it's all super interesting to me, too. So my background a little bit, I feel like I've already told the story to you guys, so I don't know if I should tell the whole thing again. But I did go to school at MIT, which is not a thing that I casually admit to in mixed company, but what can you do? Because I love science, I love math. I didn't know what I was going to do with my education there. I became a math major because I figured, hey, I'm really good at math. And I was, as embarrassing as it might be to admit, again, in mixed company. But
don't
I realized
be
one night, oh, thank you. I know, I shouldn't say that. I should be proud of liking math. And I'm the only one on the staff here that does, actually. So I have to stick up for math a lot.
Bill, are you a New England Patriots fan?
Sure. I mean, I live in Wisconsin now, so I guess if I were talking to a Wisconsin radio station, I'd have to say, yeah, go Packers. But
yeah, go Packers.
I mean, you know, I'm not super into the sports scene.
Okay, so. All right, just checking.
Yeah, I do like the Red Sox. When I lived in Cambridge, the Red Sox kind of stole my heart. So I'm a little partial to them, but a lot of my – and this is – if you talk to any MIT alum, I think you'll get the same response to a sports question. Yeah, sure, okay. Things
yeah.
neat. The physics is interesting. All right.
The
so,
physics is interesting.
That is –
yeah.
That's
it's a weird bunch of people out there. I don't know how many alums you've talked to.
A few.
Well, it's funny. Every time we do talk to someone from MIT or even maybe Harvard for that matter, John always tries to get them riled up about the Red Sox or the Patriots or whoever. And sometimes they bite and sometimes they don't. Mm-hmm. And it always leaves me mostly chuckling at John.
Okay. Well, I'm glad I could diffuse the situation.
I didn't want to interrupt your story, though. So MIT in Cambridge. And then what did you do?
Well, I was there, a hapless math major, trying to work on integrals one day, and I just realized, you know, I'm not really liking this. Is this going to be my life? Is this what I want to do forever? So I went into a little bit of a crisis mode because I realized, no, I didn't want to be working on integrals all my life. And I realized I just still like the idea of math and being able to explain it and see how it all makes sense and all the pieces fit together. And I realized, you know, maybe that could be a career, just talking about science and talking to people who do science and understanding it professionally and then being able to communicate that understanding. So knowing that, I did switch majors. I was the only writing major at MIT my year. Usually people minor in it, but I went all out. I said, I'm here. I'm already doing this. Let's do it. And, yeah, I was the only one. I sat next to the only music major my year. So we made little jokes about the engineers. Oh, that guy doesn't know Faust. As you know, surely they all were going to go on to six-figure jobs, and us not so much. But I ended up lucking out. I mean, I don't make a six-figure income, but I do work at Discover Magazine, which is kind of the closest thing to being in all of the sciences, since I talk to astronomers, I talk to biologists, I talk to anthropologists and archaeologists and just everybody. And I talk to writers who talk to all these people, too. So just reading the magazine and editing work that comes in helps keep me kind of aware of all the cool stuff that's going on. And then I can go out to cocktail parties and pretend as if I knew all this stuff on my own research. Oh, yes, did you know that Lucy, the famous fossil, might have fallen from a tree? Oh, yes, no, it came out recently, yes.
Well, Lynn drops your name all the time at cocktail parties. I've heard her do it.
But I felt my ears burning there, no wonder.
But I'm curious, what are the other publications in the Discover family?
Oh, well, you might be surprised, because Discover's kind of the odd one out at we're part of Kalmbach Publishing Company,
right.
And Astronomy Magazine is our sister magazine, so they're the only ones, we're the only, the odd ones out, because all the other titles here at Kalmbach are more hobby-focused, so a lot of Trains Magazine is a big one, Model Railroader, Toy Trains, Classic Toy Trains, a lot of those kind of niche hobby markets, and a lot of, a few beading titles as well, Bead and Button, Bead Jewelry. Recently the company started up Drone 360, and Astronomy and Discover is hoping that they can join our side of the family because they're a little more tech science related. So, a diverse crowd here at Kalmbach.
Absolutely. Well, hey, I just have one more question for you, and
sure.
This has to do with, story number 6 of 2016 in Discover's top 100 stories. You know, today, and almost as we speak right outside the KPCW studios, the Sundance Film Festival is kicking off. And unlike past years, something new this year is a theme that is being treated here at Sundance. And that theme is no less than climate change.
Mm-hmm.
So Just wondering what you would foresee as some topics that, you know, will be amongst, you know, these films, these things that are coming to the masses about climate change.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's a really important story. I mean, the backstory for our climate change story is that every year in science meeting, we talk about what are we going to do this year? Because we know it's going to be an issue. It always comes up. The news just came out, I think yesterday or earlier this week, that 2016 is definitely now the hottest year on record. I think 9 of the 10 hottest years on record have all been since 2000. So it's looking a little bit grim, depending on the science you choose to focus on. I guess some of the bigger topics coming up, oceans are going to be where a lot of the action is happening, because that's where a lot of the heat, the new heat in the planet is being stored. So coral reefs are really taking a hit. The ocean levels rising, too, is going to be pretty serious as it starts to really happen in the next few years and decades, how that influences communities, you know, that are right on the coast, that are right there, and how they deal with it might not be a really pretty sight. And it's hard to connect climate to weather, and we always say the climate is kind of the general big trends and weather is specific day-to-day activities. So you can't say, oh, this really strong hurricane, that was definitely a cause of climate change. But you can say if there's a lot more really strong hurricanes, that they're probably because of a changing climate. The higher temperatures overall in the atmosphere are making things more extreme, so a lot more extreme weather events are probably going to be coming up. So, yeah, a lot of unfortunate problems that, well, I should say obstacles, hopefully, that we can overcome. There is one story that was good news from 2016, just really quick. I think it was number 14 in our year in science, about how the ozone hole is healing. And we framed that very carefully. We started out saying, yes, finally, some good news in climate. Because it is. It's a really nice story. They discovered the ozone hole in 86. Again, it's a hole in the Earth's ozone layer. There's a layer of ozone, which is just a type of oxygen molecule. And there was a big gap of it in the atmosphere. And that's a problem, because ozone kind of blocks some of the harmful light from the sun. And they discovered this in 1986. By 1989, they put in place what's called the Montreal Protocol to ban the worst chemicals on Earth that make that hole happen, that cause it, a lot of chlorofluorocarbons and other stuff. And now, 30 years later-ish, we're seeing that the hole is definitely healing, it's definitely closing up. They can attribute a lot of it to that protocol. So
humans,
it shows that we can do things about this.
We can make a change. That's great stuff.
Exactly.
And a good note to end on. Bill Andrews, a senior associate editor for Discover Magazine, thank you so much for coming back for part two.
Oh, thank you. It was my pleasure.
Thanks, Bill.
And it's Cool Science Radio. We'll be right back. Stay with us.
Spend the day and cover billions of years at the Natural History Museum of Utah. The museum offers innovative exhibits and hands-on experiences. Native voices explore the traditions of Utah's native peoples. The Great Salt Lake Gallery tells the story of the largest saltwater lake in the Western Hemisphere. The Past Worlds exhibit includes more than a dozen new species of dinosaurs discovered right here in Utah. Visit nhmu.utah.edu. The Natural History Museum of Utah is a nonprofit organization and a KPCW supporter.
Hi, this is Angela from Peak Art and Frame, longtime supporters of KPCW. Peak Art and Frame offers custom picture framing, rush options, hanging and delivery services, and in-house designers. Open Monday through Saturday, located in the Walmart Shopping Center, 649-0801 or peakartandframe.com.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided in part by AMA Waterways and Park City Air, Cruise, and Travel, 565-4730, parkcityaircruiseandtravel.com. Park City Bike Demos, Kearns Boulevard next to Adolph's, parkcitybikedemos.com. Long, Reimer, Weininger, Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, lrw-law.com, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and listeners like you.
It's KPCW Park City.